This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
They're moving in. Millions of freshmen are getting ready for their first year of college, and one of the big questions on their mind is, did I pick the right major to help me get a job? It's a pretty important question.
We're right in the middle of a very technical 21st century economy, and the economy is going to reward people who can master those technical skills.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll talk to an economist about where the jobs are, or at least where they will be in 4 years. We'll also hear commentary about what it's like being the smart girl in class, learn about a new data-based healthcare initiative, and spend an academic minute trying to measure your overall health, whatever the heck that means. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. Picking a college major can be a bit of a crapshoot. Not many people really know what they want to do for the rest of their lives just out of high school. But many college students do just that. Pick a major and hope for the best. It might help to know what the job picture might be like in 4 years. But to help with that, let's talk to Dr. Rick Harper, Director of the Office of Economic Development and Engagement at the University of West Florida. So, Rick, let's look ahead. What majors look like they might be a good choice for getting a job in a few years?
Well, some things that never change. You can look at psychology. You can look at general business. STEM fields, science, technology, engineering, math, are heating up over a couple of years span. There's so much emphasis placed on the technical fields. After all, we're right in the middle of a very technical 21st century economy, and the economy is going to reward people who can master those technical skills, who can work effectively in a highly automated environment, work efficiently assisted by computers. And so those are some of the skills that are increasingly in demand, everything from computer science to electrical engineering. Of course, the health fields as well are very popular.
Are these areas where schools around the country are adding more program as they see they need it for more students?
Well, absolutely they are. It seems that everywhere you look, there is a new College of Health coming online at four-year universities. There are health programs coming online at community and state colleges. Schools, both public and private, have to be responsive to the demands of the marketplace. And a lot of that is driven by the way that we get things done. You know, in manufacturing, there are great jobs there, but the U.S. has shed, millions of manufacturing jobs. We've moved from an economy that was close to 20% of employment being in manufacturing a generation ago to one where just under 10% of total employment is in manufacturing. And it's because we've gotten so much better at producing things using very skilled workers as opposed to traditional manufacturing, which brought massive migration out of the South to the Rust Belt cities to the Northeast in middle of the last century for those people to come with a high school degree or perhaps not even a degree and get a good job that would sustain their family. Those sorts of jobs have largely been automated. If something is a job that embodies routine tasks that doesn't require a lot of discretionary decision-making, and of course that characterizes manufacturing to a T, then those jobs are going away, often quickly.
Well, let's talk about jobs for those students who are entering college right now. Are the fields they're going into the fields that are going to be looking for workers in 4 years?
Well, they are. The paradox, however, of some of the STEM disciplines, it's that we could double the rate of growth of network security specialists, for example. Very well-paid jobs for recent graduates. We're talking about here as we sit, jobs might in our community go for $80,000 to $90,000 for someone with relatively little experience in network security, certainly more than that in a major metro area. But we do see that the market, via the wage-setting process, is telling people where to go. And they vote with their seats in the various classrooms, and they pick the majors that are going to be the highest paid. One of the things that government could do a better job of is providing that information to students entering college and their families. It's very helpful if you're someone just about to pick a major, how wonderful if the government, instead of saying, yes, major in whatever you want, and then we'll take your taxes when you graduate, thank you very much, instead would provide information about various programs at various schools. What are the graduates of those programs making? Those data exist. I mean, we can figure out through the various labor market information agencies what are the salaries of people who graduate in, well, one surprise is marine biology. Doesn't pay very well, but an extraordinarily popular major, because who wouldn't like to go out on a boat and study marine life? It's a great field. It's a lot of fun, but often it turns out to be preparation for a higher degree, a master's or a doctorate, because there's just a real flood of people with those qualifications at the undergraduate degree level. And whereas, Bob, how much would they have to pay you to go out and be an accountant every day of your life instead of working on the radio?
What, and give up showbiz? Well, what about around the country regionally? Are the different parts of the country that have different needs?
Absolutely. The regions are different, perhaps not so much as they used to be. But if you look, for example, at the Southeast, you can see that in the warm weather vacation spots in Florida, far and away the most needed occupations are those at the lower end of the wage distribution that don't require an advanced degree. If you looked at Florida, number one, two, and three would be retail salesperson, cashier, short order food prep and serving. Those sorts of jobs, home health aide even. Whereas if you looked at a more highly educated area, if you look around Washington, D.C., for example, the federal government doesn't really hire very many people that don't already have college degrees. And so there in Arlington County, Alexandria County, Virginia, close to D.C., you would find that of adults age 25 and over, as many as 70 to 75% of those adults will have a university degree. Compare that to some of the oil drilling regions in North Dakota or in Texas, where 10 to 15% of the adult population has a university degree or higher. So yes, it's highly varied across the nation, and a lot of it depends on the business sectors, the industry sectors in the region where you live.
One thing is for sure, there's always going to be demand for highly educated workers.
Increasingly so. The wage premium has never been larger than it is today for getting your university degree versus not getting a degree. And the worst off of all, of course, are those people who take out a large dollar value of student loans but don't manage to get their degree completed. They finish with the loan but without the benefit of the degree.
Dr. Rick Harper is director of the Office of Economic Development and Engagement at the University of West Florida. Soraya Shockley is smart, and she says that's been a bit of a problem going through school because she also describes herself as socially awkward. She talks about that dilemma in this commentary for Youth Radio.
In high school, I was known as the smart girl. Not the fun girl or the nice girl, but the smart girl. I'm Soraya Shockley with a commentary from Youth Radio. I wasn't invited to sleepovers or to hang out on weekends. What I thought of as interesting conversation, politics, science, current events, was seen as boring or showing off. Feeling isolated, I became depressed, lonely, and withdrawn. But instead of giving in to those feelings, I tried harder socially. I threw myself into clubs, sports, and musicals, and things did get better. I made friends and built a bomb resume. And this past semester, I was rewarded with an acceptance to Harvard. Still, I worry because all my social will seems to have dried up. I'm scared that at Harvard, I won't be able to muster this sort of effort twice. I know I have to let go of my high school reservations that have held me back socially and emotionally. College is new, and I'll just have to keep reminding myself that this time it can be different. For Youth Radio, I'm Soraya Shockley.
Still to come, there's a new U.S. healthcare initiative that's driven by data. We'll learn about it next on The Best of Our Knowledge. caught any questions or comments about the best of our knowledge, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to the Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. The Million Hearts Initiative is a nationwide effort by the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services to try and prevent 1 million heart attacks and strokes by 2017. One of the newest participants in this initiative is Sacred Heart Medical Group. To learn more about this data-based program, I spoke with Dr. Andrew Henson. He's a family physician at Sacred Heart Medical Group practicing in Pace, Florida, about how he got involved in the program and how it works.
So the Million Hearts Initiative is an initiative that's coming through the Centers of Medicaid and Medicare. It's an initiative focused on using preventative treatments to prevent heart attack and stroke in the general population.
Basically, we've been working in the U.S. on a reactive, and this is trying to go the other way, right?
That's exactly right, yeah. I mean, the United States healthcare has generally been delivered in a sort of waiting manner, meaning we sort of let people get to the point to where they have a heart attack or a stroke, and then we start doing some back work to try to prevent more. What Million Hearts is really involved with is getting to the patients before those events happen, getting them on the right medicines, getting the right tests done so that we hopefully prevent a great number of those cardiovascular events, because in the United States, cardiovascular disease is the number one killer. So this is a big important initiative going on.
And the face of heart disease has really changed over the years. It's not just that, you know, stressed out middle-aged executive who's overweight and hard drinking and hard smoking, is it?
Absolutely right. I mean, the way heart disease has evolved and the way that we have seen the United States healthcare landscape evolve, we found that not only is it just the upper middle-aged stressed out guys, now we see women, we see people happening at a younger age, and that's for a variety of reasons. The American diet, exercise, obesity rates are higher, and people generally don't take good care of themselves. So what our goal is to not just implement the medications, which is a big part, but also to talk to patients about lifestyle intervention and about what we can do as a group to help them achieve their goals for not only their weight and their health, but also their goals of ultimately preventing that catastrophic disease.
Sacred Heart just became involved in this. How did that involvement take place?
Yeah, this has been several months in the making. So around 6 months ago, I was approached by one of the medical directors here at Sacred Heart to see if I would be interested in getting involved in a preventative healthcare initiative. And that was the Million Hearts. Sacred Heart, as we know, and anyone sort of in the Gulf Coast area knows, is a very heavily involved in cardiovascular health. So this was a natural fit for us. The joke we sort of have is that we're kind of looking to make it so we aren't needing that cardiovascular health as much, because on the primary care level, we're going to get in and start attacking this preventative care. Now, of course, we're always going to need our partners in cardiovascular care, but the more we can do on the primary care level with your family doctor or your internist, the more we can do to prevent patients from developing this cardiovascular disease and hopefully increase the quality of life, because that's what it's all about.
I have read that this is a data-driven approach. How does that work?
Absolutely, it's data-driven. So away from the tradition of just sort of treating patients as they walk through the door, what we're doing is when patients come in, instead of sort of just getting a cholesterol check and saying, well, your number is X, so you need this dose of medicine, what Million Hearts does and what we've really focused on here at Sacred Heart is taking your cholesterol numbers and putting it into a calculator that was developed by the American Heart Association to calculate risk. So we're not just talking about numbers. We're based on your cholesterol numbers, based on your age, your sex, your blood pressure, based on risk factors like smoking and diabetes, we're actually able to tell you what your risk of heart attack or stroke is in the next 10 years, and in some cases, over the course of your lifetime. So for us, that's been really powerful, because telling someone your LDL or your bad cholesterol is 170 might not mean much. Telling somebody your risk of having a heart attack in the next 10 years is 30% is a lot more powerful.
And who can participate in this?
So right now, we are looking at people who are involved in the Medicare population. So that can be anyone between, I believe, the ages of 40 and 75. And these are patients who have not had a heart attack or stroke because what, like we said, our goal is to sort of prevent that initial cardiovascular event. So we are really going to be focused on trying to identify those patients and get them enrolled if they are interested.
Okay, you enroll in this. What's your next step as a patient?
Mm-hmm. So as a patient, the enrollment is effectively agreeing to be a part of the data collection because this is something we're being measured on. We're not just doing this in the hopes of preventing heart attacks. We're trying to gather data and see how we stack up versus other people around the nation. So when you enroll, what will happen is you will be told you're enrolled in the Million Hearts Initiative, and then there will be some services and hopefully some interventions available to you that we're still working on. One thing that we've talked about is getting people involved with nutritionists and exercise physiologists so that, again, we're not just treating those numbers, we're treating the whole patient. And that's really reflected in what we do with our big group. Our group on the Million Hearts Initiative at Sacred Heart is made up of several people. It's not just physicians. It's family doctors. It's internal medicine doctors. It's cardiologists. And outside of that, we have nutritionists. We have exercise science. We have people from social work. We have people from administration. All of us creating a multidisciplinary team to try to deliver healthcare in a more robust way than just going to one doctor and getting one medicine.
How many people you got in it so far?
So we just began enrolling. We just found out that we were put into the initiative and accepted in within the last month. So currently what we're doing is we're starting to go through our offices in an attempt to identify some patients who could be involved. In my practice, the way I'm doing it is I see patients coming through who meet those criteria. I'm keeping a list of them. And then when we actually begin the initiative, which will be sometime this winter, those patients will be identified and reached out to, and we will start getting them involved in some of these programs that we have available.
Do you see some patients who you look at and say, just keep doing what you're doing?
Sometimes. You know, I think that in healthcare, that is a little bit of a slippery slope. I don't think there's ever a place where you can't improve something. What I tend to do is I like to look at patients in a really pretty holistic way. There are patients who I have who are very good about their diet. They're very cognizant about their exercise. And those are patients where I say, listen, you're on the right track here. But when I, instead of saying, just keep doing what you're doing, I tend to say, you know, what are you doing? And do you think there's anywhere in there that you could improve with diet or exercise or even just the activities of daily living where you could really improve your quality of life? Because one of the things that's often overlooked, I think, with cardiovascular care is that it's not just about the cholesterol. It's not just about the exercise. It's also about the stress of life. It's about your emotional well-being. And these things can always be worked on. I don't think there's ever a time where you can't look at your life and say, where can I cut out some of the stress? So that's one of the things that I talk to my patients about fairly frequently.
You talked about this being with the Medicare population. Is this all paid for?
So patients have no cost to be involved in this. And actually, the thing that's really interesting about it is in the medical healthcare system, we're fee for service. You come to the doctor, you pay your fee, and that's how doctors are paid. The way this is actually looking at it is we will actually be paid in some ways based on the results we get. So as we work through the Million Hearts and we start submitting some of the results we're getting with patients, how well we do and how big of an intervention we make will really depend on how much money we're reimbursed to be a part of this. So it puts everybody getting a little bit of skin in the game. So the doctor has some skin in the game in that we have a vested interest in taking care of the patients and reducing cardiovascular risk. The patients have that same goal. They want to reduce their risk, increase their health. But the healthcare system as a whole, Sacred Heart, has a vested interest because if we enroll in this and we do nothing to improve the health of our patients, the compensation we receive certainly will be less than if we make a big difference and impact in this population.
What didn't I ask you about this you think people should know?
I think the biggest thing people should know is that with cardiovascular care, it's not just about going to the doctor every now and again, making sure your numbers are okay. It's really about making an investment in your life and your healthcare. I really think that when patients make the commitment to say, I want to live a healthier life, physicians can be a partner in that. But as we have done with Sacred Heart, getting multiple different places involved between dietary and doctors and administration, patients need to be an active player in that healthcare. They need to be one of the people at the table saying, these are the things I'm willing to do to really help with my healthcare. And we as physicians and we as a healthcare team are there to help guide them through that. So that's the biggest thing I would say is that patients who are eligible for this, or even ones that aren't, just patients who are concerned about their health, really take an active role in that healthcare and be willing and open to doing as much as you can to make yourself healthier and hopefully happier.
Is this open to any non-Medicare patients?
So Million Hearts specifically is not.
Okay.
Million Hearts is a Medicare initiative, but that doesn't mean we can't employ the same things through patients who are not Medicare. So, for example, patients in my practice who are not Medicare patients who maybe have private insurance or are Medicaid patients, I do the same risk calculator that I do for all the patients who are in Million Hearts, and I treat them with the same sort of robust approach as I would somebody outside of it. The reason I do that is because it's the right thing to do. The healthcare system does not get reimbursed any better or anything like that for that. I do it because I believe it's the right thing to do. And I would venture to say that is pretty well a Sacred Heart Medical Group initiative. We all tend to treat all the patients the same. The thing that's interesting about Million Hearts is, and the reason we've identified the Medicare group is because they are enrolled in Medicare, so they're easier to report data for. I do this same thing for everyone. So if this is something you're interested in but you don't think you fit, you can certainly ask your doctors who are participating in this about it, and we can apply the same things to you that we would to anyone else.
Dr. Andrew Henson is a family physician at Sacred Heart Medical Group in Pace, Florida. You can learn more about the program at millionhearts.hhs.gov. As you get older, there will, of course, be changes in your overall health. So is overall health something that can actually be measured? That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Is age just a number, or does everyone follow the path of aging? I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of the Association of American Colleges and Universities. And today on the Academic Minute, Martha McClintock, professor in the Department of Comparative Human Development and Psychology at the University of Chicago, takes a look at all the facets of health and whether there are some surprising results.
Doctors traditionally view health through the lens of disease, but the World Health Organization has a broader definition, including mental and social well-being. My colleagues and I wanted to test how our understanding of health in older Americans changes with this more comprehensive model and determine if it would better predict the likelihood of dying or becoming incapacitated. When all of the aspects of health are thrown into the mix, would everyone share the same pattern of aging that correlates with chronological age, or would there be different patterns with people following different aging trajectories? We surveyed a representative sample of 3,000 people aged 57 to 85, which means our findings apply to all Americans in this age group who live at home. Working with NORC, a survey research organization, we collected data not just about their diseases and medications, but their social lives, their mental health, mobility, and sensory function. We then returned 5 years later to find out who was still alive and how they were doing. Our analysis revealed some surprising findings. There is not one pattern or health class, but six classes, and age is not a key determinant of health differences among older Americans. Breaking a bone after age 45 defines one health class and poor mental health another, both obscured by the medical model and yet major indicators of future health issues. The healthiest class is obese, robust people, so obesity seems to pose little risk to older adults in excellent physical and mental health. Our study shows how the health of older Americans isn't solely a medical matter. People need to start thinking about a mosaic of strengths and weaknesses, from past injuries to the importance of social interactions.
That was Martha McClintock of the University of Chicago. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with the Association of American Colleges and Universities. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. While you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other national productions or WAMC podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.